Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Operators, where we learn from the people building the companies of tomorrow. You can find us online at operators.co. The Operators features entrepreneurs and execs from companies like Google, Facebook, Slack, and WeWork sharing insights on how to break into a field, how to build a successful career, and how to hire and manage talent beyond your own expertise. Tune in to hear from the people doing the real day-to-day work, the people who make it all happen, the people who know what it really takes, the operators. Today, we're talking to two media operators. Our guests are bringing experience from helping build teams at the likes of the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg News, Smart News, and The Hustle. Before we meet our guests today, I'd like to note that today's episode is sponsored by Hamama. Hamama makes it crazy easy to grow superfood microgreens at your home year-round. Just add water once, come back to harvest in a week, and add your delicious homegrown greens to smoothies, salads, sandwiches, and more. Head to hamama.com/operators and use code operators for 15% off your first order. And now let's jump in. I'm your host, Tim Shaw, and we're coming to you today from downtown San Francisco. Joining me is Rich Jaroslawski, the VP of Content at Smart News. Also joining us is Sam Parr, the co-founder and CEO of The Hustle. And in full disclosure, I'm a small investor in The Hustle. Rich and Sam, thank you for joining us. Just to start, if you can share with our listeners your path and how you found yourself to where you are today, that would be great.
Well, I have what I've long said is the most eccentric resume in American news. I was journalist for the Wall Street Journal for many years, most of them in Washington, D.C. I was White House correspondent, national political editor. And then in the mid-90s, I got an offer that was too good to pass up to move to New York and start up what became WSJ.com. So it was not something that I had ever really been on my horizon, but the opportunity just seemed like it would be so much fun, win or lose. And it turned out to be a huge, a huge win as far as I was concerned for my career and for my path. So for the last 25 years, I've been involved in digital news at WSJ.com, at Bloomberg. I started an organization called the Online News Association, been at Smart News now for 5 years, and I teach a class in the history of online news at the University of California.
I think you went to Stanford for undergrad.
I did, and I get a lot of needling from my Stanford friends because I'm the only person at Stanford class reunions that has a Berkeley faculty card in my wallet.
Nice. And can you share with us a bit about Smart News?
Sure. Smart News is a machine learning-driven, algorithmically curated news aggregation app with a difference from a lot of other news sources, which is that rather than being optimized for excessive personalization, we are optimized for discovery, exposing people to content, stories, and viewpoints that they might not otherwise see.
Awesome. And at Smart News, what's your role?
I'm vice president for content and chief journalist. And I have two major roles. One is to oversee the content team, working with the engineers, working with the data scientists and the technologists to make sure that we're doing what we intend to do in terms of delivering content. And I also oversee the team that negotiates agreements with publishers. And we have about 400 media partners in the U.S. alone, some of the biggest names, most of the biggest names in media. We kind of pride ourselves on being good partners to media organizations, and our incentives are closely aligned. If our media partners do well, we'll do well, and vice versa.
And so not throwing any underhanded throws, future of digital media in the United States. Are you bullish, pessimistic?
Well, I think the future of digital media writ large is very bright. But I am concerned about the unintended consequences of that future. And one of the things that distinguishes us, I think, at Smart News is that, you know, we take responsibility for the technology. The technology is only as good and responsible as the people behind it. And we take very seriously our role in trying to strengthen democracy rather than to undermine it.
Amazing. Sam,
What's going on?
Good to see you.
Yes, you too. So I own this company called The Hustle. We're an information company, a business news organization. A lot of people call us a media company. We're most known for our daily email, The Hustle, which is a daily email that gives millions of people a day the business news and information they need to know. And then we also have a subscription product called Trends. That's a paid product that we just launched that's doing quite well. And we have a line of conferences called HustleCon and a whole bunch of other events. We did 20, 30 events last year. So, we're just a 30-person media company that's just turned 3 years old and trying to become huge.
Amazing. So events, business intelligence, and newsletter.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about online media? And I mean, everyone, and the reason I ask this is...
Well, from what perspective? From like a money-making perspective? Or what's your outlook? From what perspective are you looking for?
I think from first a user perspective.
I think it's awesome. I think that, like, so if you watch TV or YouTube, I think the content's amazing. I am obsessed with YouTube. I love all the YouTubers. I love all the shows that are on YouTube.
Any Hustle YouTube anytime soon?
We have one there, but it's not getting as much love. We're really focused on like one or two things that we're doing, and we kind of ignore everything else. So not planned yet, but YouTube is awesome. I don't have cable. I only watch YouTube. So my outlook is very positive from a business and money making perspective. I think a lot of people are going to go out of business because they have horrible businesses. But I think that, there's a lot of really large businesses can be built in this space still, even though many people are pessimistic, particularly people in the media world are pessimistic. But, I think there's a lot of room for build big companies. And I think from a user's point of view, from a content point of view, it's freaking awesome. Everything on Netflix is great. Hulu's awesome. I love it all.
Which media companies, actually, before we talk about media companies, would you all describe Smart News and Hustle as a media company, as a technology company, hybrid? I feel like every company is a technology company today.
My answer to that question, is Smart News a media company or a technology company, is yes. You can't not be both in this environment. If you are, just think of yourself as a media company without considering the technology, you have no brain. And if you just consider yourself a technology company without considering the importance of media, you have no soul. So you got to be both.
I don't even think about it. I never ask myself that question. Sometimes I say media company if I'm just meeting people on the fly because I don't feel like diving too deep into what it is. Anyone who is a user of ours kind of understands it. But I don't think about it. I think that we're a brand that makes content. I think that we could go and open up a shared office or sell T-shirts and people would buy it and like it. So then are we a T-shirt company? I don't know. So I'm not offended if someone calls us that. I never even think about it.
What are some media/media tech companies that you all admire, and what is it that you all admire about them?
I can go first. I like, in terms of like traditional digital media, I think everything Barstool is doing from a brand is just, it's on point. I don't care if you agree or disagree with them. Their numbers speak for themselves, and it's amazing. People are fanatical about that brand. And they've grown like crazy. I think I read that they're going to do close to $100 million in revenue this year. And people are fanatical about them. So I really respect what they do, but that's a pretty easy answer. Everyone says that, or a lot of people say it.
Do you fall in Barstool's target demographic, you think, or are you a consumer of their content?
I'm not a sports fan, but, my girlfriend listens to their podcast constantly. So she listens to them out loud. So I'm always listening to their podcasts. So yeah, I consume them. I think they're great. So I think they're, in terms of media, I think they're fantastic. I also love, I'm kind of obsessed right now with a lot of the B2B media companies. So some of the huge brands like Informa or Penske Media, things like that, I really like right now because they're growing really nicely, but they're doing it in a pretty quiet way because it's kind of an unsexy niche.
And then can you share a bit about Informa Penske? Like Informa's events.
Yeah, so Informa is kind of interesting. Their CEO said at their last earnings call that they're one of the biggest companies that you've never heard about. So they own loads of different brands. They own maybe 100 different brands. And so what they do is they basically have free content that's advertising-based. They have subscription products, and they have huge trade shows. But they probably own 100 different brands. And they just use that same a tripod playbook across all their brands. And, I mean, they're quite large. Maybe last year they did, $5 billion in revenue.
And then Penske?
Yeah, that's owned by Jay Penske. His dad is the guy who started the trucking company. Yellow trucks. They own Variety, I believe. They own a whole bunch of Hollywood-based titles, a lot of entertainment industry stuff, a lot of insider stuff, and I think they're really interesting as well. They're private, so I have no idea how big they are, but I believe quite large.
Rich?
Well, I'll endorse Sam's views of Penske because they're partners of ours, but I'm going to punt on the rest. Because we have 400 publisher partners, and I have two kids, and I love them both equally. If I start naming names, I'm going to leave somebody really good out.
Nice. In terms of future media, email newsletter, events, mobile app, you said you like YouTube. Is content going to be further fragmented, and you're just going to consume it wherever it is? How do you think about where media is evolving?
And are you guys ad supported?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I've one of the things that I've done at various times in my career that I didn't mention earlier is that I've written about technology going back to the PC era, and as recently as up till about 5 years ago was doing a consumer tech column for Bloomberg and then continued writing for Observer.com about consumer tech. And one of the questions that I tried to address periodically in my column was what's next after the cell phone? I mean, the cell phone was an enormous paradigm shift. You know, the iPhone really revolutionized not just telephony and personal communication, but it revolutionized media as well. So the question, that I both get asked and ask frequently is, what is the next platform after the phone? And my answer to that is that the next platform is not necessarily going to be hardware based, but is going to be the cloud of connectivity that surrounds you wherever you are. So in a lot of ways, you're the platform. You may be consuming news as I do in the morning while I'm making the bed via Alexa or Google Home. You may be consuming content on your phone, certainly, but you will be consuming content pretty much everywhere around you. So in a lot of ways, I think you're the next platform.
Sam?
What's the next platform? Is that the question?
Or where do you see media evolving to?
Oh, man. That's a challenging question to answer. I would say that I think that a lot of these young individual guys who are just filming themselves with their phone or
influencers,
I guess you can call them that. I think that that's kind of silly, but maybe the people, they also fall in that category. But man, some of these kids, they're like young kids. Like I just saw this thing today. Remember when Trump said that thing about Baltimore? Well, this guy just got his cell phone and he went and interviewed these people on the streets of Baltimore and asked, what's your opinion on that? And I got some really amazing insight. Some that I agree, some that I don't agree with, but it was wonderful. I thought that it was just an amateur guy, but I learned way more from that than I did CNN or Fox or the big networks. And so what I think someone smart who wants to build a big company, I think what they'll do is figure out how to roll up a lot of these individual folks and give them access to a lot of resources or put all the back-end operations together. But what I see is the future is I think these individual folks are just going to continue getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and the big media companies are just going to shrink.
That sounds like a multi-channel network.
Yeah, and so those were huge when, 5 years ago, 6 years ago? They didn't pan out, I don't believe.
Too early?
Yeah, maybe, probably. Yeah, I think Maker, was that the big one? That got acquired. I mean, they made a killing, but I don't know if it turned out to be well for them.
And then Disney wrote it off.
Did they? Yeah, so no, it didn't work out for those folks. I think that could still be done. Man, some of these young people that are just, it's a one or two person operation, I think they get way more attention and they have way more influence than any of the big name folks.
Who are some of these YouTubers that you watch? Like, I mean, I think I watch Casey Neistat.
I watch him. I like this young woman named Janelle. Did you see her? The woman that got popular. She released one video, and in 2 weeks, she got something like 2 million subscribers. She just talked about living in a van. That's all she talked about. But she was wonderful. So I've been watching her lately. I kind of like this, where some of my favorite podcasts, they film it, and I watch those on YouTube, the little clips all the time. And then there's loads of like individual channels of people who talk about sports, and I find myself to be significantly more influenced by them than I am ESPN.
Hmm. In terms of your day-to-day function as a media operator, how many people, first you rich, how many people do you interact with? What are their roles? What are some of the goals that you have set for your team this year?
Well, one of the great things about Smart News being a startup is, and we're actually, our headquarters are in Tokyo, is that I'm interacting with a hugely diverse cast of people. My own teams are you know, more content oriented and business development oriented, but I'm also dealing with and interacting with product people, with machine learning engineers, with you know, a huge cast that earlier in my career, my gosh, if somebody from the business side of the Wall Street Journal walked through the newsroom, everybody would stop what they were doing. You know, who is this foreign visitor? But the enormous fun of being in this environment today is that you're dealing with, you know, a hugely diverse cast of characters, all of whom are working towards the same goal, but working from very different perspectives.
And Rich, we skipped over you in terms of some of the media companies. Oh, actually, no, you answered. You couldn't answer.
I avoided that's answering, right, that's right. To be honest.
Sam, how about you in terms of your day-to-day?
Yeah, view? So we're a lot smaller than you guys. We have about 30 people. We've just hired someone to be the president of our company, which means he reports to me.
And congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It's great because now I don't have to do all the stuff I didn't want to do. So he handles a lot of the day-to-day stuff, and I touch most every project in some little way. Like, I'll kind of give an opinion, or I'll ask if I can contribute or how I can help. But we just turned 3 last April, so I've done every job. I was our first writer. I was our first ad salesman. I hosted all the events, built some of the technology. So I've done everything, and I still interact with everyone. But on a day-to-day level, I think a lot. I do a lot of hiring, and just like, this sounds like such a weak answer. A lot of thinking. Like, I think about like what we can do next.
I don't think that's a weak answer at all. I used to be widely ridiculed at WSJ.com because I would complain that the one thing I didn't have time to do was think.
Yeah.
And getting the time to think.
It's important.
I think is one of the most important and underrated responsibilities of a leader in this environment.
Yeah. So, I mean, there'll be days, particularly on like Wednesdays, where I try not to schedule anything, and I'll put my Slack on silent, and I just poke around at all of our numbers, and or I'll call users, or I'll talk to them on Facebook, or I just talk to people. And in doing that, they'll tell me something that's interesting, and I'll just like write it down, and I'll just sit there and think about it.
For years, I made it a point, and I still do when I can, of never taking vacation the last week in August. And the reason for that is because so many other people are taking vacations the last week in August, and that means there are fewer people around, fewer interruptions, and a little more time to think.
Yeah, I love that. I also I like to stay really late at the office, and it's like so quiet and nice. Or I like to get in really early. But my answer is I think a lot, but I interact with everyone, and I have done every single job.
What are a few things you wish you knew back then when you started your career in media?
Well, you know, when I started my career in media, distribution was primarily with a chisel and a piece of rock that you would carve letters into.
You don't go that far.
Sometimes it feels like it. Sometimes it feels like it. The truth is, and I'm really dating myself, when I joined the Wall Street Journal, I wrote my stories on a manual typewriter with special carbonized paper so that there'd be multiple copies. It seems so quaint now, but I do go back that far. I think that the things that I kind of wish I had known earlier in my career were that all the things worth doing are the things where you can't quite see where they're going to end or how they're going to end. And the other thing that I wish I'd known earlier in my career was that all that time I spent learning all the copy editing symbols that you use when you're copy editing something with a pencil on paper, totally useless.
I want to double click. Worth doing what you can't really see. It feels like essentially embracing risk.
Yeah. I mean, and I am probably the most risk-averse person that I know. And when the opportunity to start up what became WSJ.com came along, you know, I was very well established in Washington. I had a pretty well-known byline. I'd done a lot of interesting stuff. My colleagues in Washington, a lot of them thought I was committing career suicide. My wife and I kind of sat down and did the classic, okay, what's the best that can happen? What's the worst that can happen? And basically the best that could happen was I'd get to, help shape a new medium. I'd get to build a team from scratch. I'd get to exercise muscles that I hadn't exercised before. And the best that could happen would be that it was a success. And when we listed, well, what's the worst that could happen? Essentially, it was the exact same things, except the last item on the list was, it fails. And when we looked at it that way, it was actually an easy call. So it looked very strange to a lot of my colleagues, but it made perfect sense to me. And it turned out that decision was probably the key decision of my entire career, and I would not have recognized it as such when I made it.
So it seems like your career has been defined by a fair bit of taking risk, but it feels that media generally as an industry has not been very risk-embracive. Would you say that's a fair description or not?
I think that's an eminently fair description. I am a veteran of that era where, a lot of traditional media was very dismissive of the online medium. That was one of the impetuses behind why we founded the Online News Association, which is about to have our 20th anniversary in New Orleans next month. I'm really excited about that. But it was at a time when traditional media was extremely dismissive of the online medium. And, I think time has shown that, there was a lot of... if I can use the word, willful ignorance on the part of traditional media. And, I think there's less of that now. I think that the travails of traditional media have tended to focus attention much more. And there's also been a generational shift in the leadership. So people are a little bit more willing to embrace risk. The definition of insanity is supposedly, keep doing the same thing and think the outcome will be different. And it's just insane to keep trying to make the old models work when the evidence all suggests that it won't.
For sure. So today, the majority of digital ad spend, or maybe even all ad spend, definitely digital, is Facebook and Google. In the 70s, 80s, and 90s, this is a question that... Rich, I love your insight on how powerful were the traditional print media, and did they not embrace change simply because they were so entrenched and so fat and happy?
I think a lot of it was that way. I used to have friends who worked on the business side of print media that would complain that they weren't salespeople; they were order takers. And when the world changed and they actually had to get out and sell, that was a new experience for them. You also had people who were very defensive in terms of the legacy product was the cash cow. And, you know, you wouldn't do anything to jeopardize the cash cow. But the problem with that is that eventually a cash cow stops giving cash. And if you have not moved with the times, you're in big trouble. I really believe that you have to eat your own lunch, because otherwise somebody else will come along and eat it for you.
Jeff Bezos says every day is like day one or something like that. I guess one more question, Rich, about risk, especially through your journey, is that I recall reading somewhere, or maybe you told me that there was some debate as to building a paywall in Wall Street Journal, and that like on day one you decided to take that risk. Is that right?
Yeah, there was huge debate, not only within Dow Jones, the journal's publisher, but also with other publishers who, you know, this was the era of information wants to be free. And here we were at the Journal, you know, building something that was going to have a paywall from day one. And I still remember the meeting that I had with the president of our division, who came to me one day and said, "Rich, I know why, you know, the business people and other people are supporting a paywall for WSJ.com, but you're the editor. I would think you'd want it to be free to reach the biggest possible audience. Why are you in favor of a paywall?" And my answer, which may be backwards logic, but it was the way I felt and still feel, was this was a new medium. People didn't yet see or understand just how incredibly valuable and powerful this medium was going to be. I felt that we were building something at WSJ.com that was going to be of genuine value. And the surest way that I could think of to prove to people that it had value was to make them pay for it. And that was not a popular view at the time within either the media industry or the internet industry. And I still have the scars to prove it. But I think time has proven that was a pretty smart decision we made.
Did Rupert Murdoch at all weigh in, or do you know if he weighed in on this matter?
Well, Rupert back then did not own the journal. And it was the Bancroft family, and the company was at that point independent. When Rupert...
Did the Bancrofts own the Washington Post at the same time?
No, that was the Grahams.
Grahams, my bad.
Yeah. But the when I left the journal before Murdoch took over Dow Jones, when he first cut the deal to buy it from the Bancrofts, he made some statements that, you know, he was going to lift the paywall and make it all free. And then very early on, he reversed course and said, well, maybe not so fast. And they decided not to get rid of the paywall, and indeed, you know, it now it's become very common for high quality news sites to have a paywall. But if you look at, for example, the New York Times, they made the opposite decision in the 90s. They were free, it took them until about 6 or 7 years ago before they could actually enforce a paywall and make the business work. And that's arguably the most powerful brand in American journalism. It took them that long to be able to, you know, to sustain that model. Whereas Dow Jones, we did it at the Journal from the mid-90s. So, you know, I think the thing we used to tell each other, though we never said it publicly at the time, was if we were wrong and information really did want to be free, and people would never pay for content on the internet, it would be a hell of a lot easier to go from paid to free than it would be to go from free to paid. And that, too, I think time has shown to be correct.
So you made some decisions that were decades later very prescient and correct. I'm curious, these days, it feels like all the quality publications are becoming paywalled. And I'm curious, do you think that's just going to fracture the media market between quality journalism is free, clickbait is not free, and essentially a stratification of
media? You mean the opposite? Quality?
Yes.
Quality is paid and clickbait's free?
That's right. And really, like, stratifying, like, what type of content people can access.
I don't know it'll be that clean because there is quality content, for example, local content that is quality and relevant to people, but they may not have a big enough market or a powerful enough brand to sustain a paywall. So it's not as clean as that, I don't think.
Speaking of paywalls and free products, Sam, how do you think about that?
Yeah, we just launched our first paid subscription service. We don't have any content on our site, or at least it's not easy to find. It was only email-based, and so the plan was, let's start a paid publication. And I agree, it's really hard to go from free to paid, at least if you're like, who all's doing it? Like, I don't know, Vogue or...
Wired, Atlantic,
yeah, if you're like the Atlantic or Wired, I think you're going to struggle really hard. For us, we didn't have like a website that you would go to. So it was almost as if we were starting from scratch. And that has helped us. We have thousands of people who pay us $300 a year. It's still small, but we'll get to hundreds of thousands eventually. But yeah, I agree. You asked him earlier what you had known when you first started. I wish I would have known I could have charged people from the get-go and it would have worked. I think that we were talking about earlier about the Japanese media companies. A lot of those folks have been doing that, and it's quite fascinating. And it's popular in China as well. It's normal. It's part of the culture to pay for information, at least more so than it is here. And I think that America is becoming that. And it already was that, but it went through this period where a lot was free. But now I think it's going to change. So yeah, I like paid stuff.
Context, you mentioned, Rich, is very important in terms of what can be paywalled and what can't be paywalled. How do you feel, like, do you feel everything is moving to the paywalled side? Like, I guess, how do you feel the evolution of paywalls will happen?
I don't think everything will. I think there is still a place for large-scale free media. You know, if you are one of our big partners is CNN.com. You know, it's high quality content. They don't charge for it. You know, I think that that there will still be a market for very powerful brands that have the scale that can make an advertising model work. But there are a lot of very good publishers that that don't have that ability. And, you know, I worry about them because, as Sam said, you know, they may struggle to make a paid model work, but they don't necessarily have the scale to make free model work either. Those are the ones that I think are most at risk.
I would even say I think CNN's at risk. I saw their viewership was down. But like even they're not even big. I wonder if they're big enough to make advertising work, at least to make, like, I would love to own a business that makes $100 million a year in ad revenue, but I think that their expectations are even higher than that, right? Like, it's like very, very high. And it's going to be hard, I think, what's BuzzFeed's revenue? $300 or $400 million? I mean, that's a lot, but that's not a lot when you've raised money at a $8 billion or $6 billion valuation. It's like these, so their expectations are huge. So I wonder if even CNN will be able to make it work. I get nervous about that.
It's really interesting. I mean, one of the trends that I talk about in my Berkeley class is you know, the trend of carriers being concerned about becoming dumb pipes and wanting to find ways to share in the value of the bits flowing through their pipes. So you now have CNN owned by AT&T and HBO owned by AT&T, and you now have Huffington Post owned by Verizon and NBC.
TechCrunch owned by Verizon.
And NBC owned by Comcast. So, you know, I think that, you know, you're seeing increasingly the convergence of carriage and content because that's the only way that some of these companies can see to move forward. You know, the carriers don't want to become commoditized as dumb pipes, and their way around it is to acquire content. But I think it's an open question, at least in my mind, whether that is going to work.
Sam, any thoughts on that? I guess my follow-up question is carriage and content, but from what I feel and what I see is technology companies becoming content companies.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that the pipes, there won't be a lot more pipes. Like, everyone will be able to have their own. I think that what I think is going to happen in the next 5 years is you're going to see dozens and dozens of pretty large companies being built on very niche audiences, and they're going to be able to charge a lot of money for their service. I think that's what we're going to see a lot of, and I think that it's going to really hurt a lot of the cable companies. I also think that a lot of the mid-sized media brands like HuffPost, I'll say it on record, I think they're going to be out of business in 2 years. I think a lot of those folks will be out of business in 2 years. None of them, they all have relatively large audiences that are getting slightly smaller each year, but brands that are not strong enough that people are going to pay them money because they are used to getting that stuff for free for a decade. It's interesting. I think that I wonder if the cable companies will even exist. Like, they're just going to have to be internet companies, really. Internet providers.
So I feel like generally there's been a convergence of carriage and content, and also technology companies and content, content companies becoming technology companies. So I would say Disney traditionally is a media company. Now they have their streaming service, right? Netflix was a technology company, or really a DVD provider / streaming service. Now they have their own shows. I think generally one fair assumption or takeaway is just the convergence of what is a technology company versus a content company versus a carriage company.
Well, to me at least, that's a goal or a shimmering vision that companies have been pursuing for quite a long time. I mean, most people at this point don't remember it, but what does the MS in MSNBC stand for?
Microsoft.
Long before it was the liberal cable outlet of Rachel Maddow, it was a news site that was jointly created by Microsoft and NBC. So you've had media and technology companies pursuing this for quite a while, but it's one thing to pursue it, and it's another thing to actually pull it off. And so the question in my mind is, who is well enough placed to be able to pull that off, to marry the technology with the content in an intelligent way? That's one of the reasons that it's one of the things that attracted me to Smart News. We're not a big company, but we have state-of-the-art machine learning technology, and we're trying to marry that with high-quality content in a way that works for users and helps broaden people's perspectives rather than narrow them.
Advice to people who want to join media.
I have a joke. I always tell our team, niches make riches. Start with one really very, very specific audience. It doesn't matter if it's as little as 10,000 people, and just make stuff that they absolutely love. Do not try to make something that loads and loads and loads of people like. Just create something that one or two people truly love, and building a business is very easy if you do that. It doesn't matter if you sell advertising or if you sell subscriptions or t-shirts. If you just something that like very few people are incredibly passionate about, it will work. I don't know if it will be like huge, but you will always be able to pay the bills.
You mentioned niche a couple times. What are some niche properties you think are doing fantastic?
I like DigiDay. I like those folks a lot. That's a media one. And AdAge, that's another media one. I think that there's a lot that are being created right now. I think we're one of them. I think 2PM with Webb Smith. I don't know if you know who that is. He does e-commerce and retail. I think that's wonderful. There's a company called Industry Dive. They're only 5 years old, but they're growing very nicely. And they create individual newsletters for like the construction industry, the oil industry, and they're doing really, really well. There's a whole bunch of journals for lawyers. I believe it's called the American Attorney Journal, I believe it's called. Very large business. I think they're awesome. I think institutionalinvestor.com, they're owned by Euromoney. It's a publicly traded English company. I love reading that. I think they're doing a really good job. They're just for hedge fund managers and things like that. Anything else? Those are a handful.
So it feels like for these niche companies, it's very, they're serving like industry. It's very vertical specific.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be. Hypebeast is awesome. They do tennis shoes, or I don't know, I'm not part of that community. Streetwear, I guess you call it. Hypebeast is awesome. They're publicly traded in Hong Kong and they're doing wonderful. So that is industry specific, but that's not B2B. So you can, they do a really good job, I think.
Back in the 90s, when we were starting WSJ.com, you know, I was constantly having these little epiphanies like, oh my God, this is different than print, which was my background at the time. And one of the little epiphanies I had early on in our WSJ.com experience was in print. Print is basically a two-dimensional medium. You print the information that's going to be of interest to the largest number of people, which is why every print newspaper used to print, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the weather, because lots of people wanted to know that. But as a result of the fact that everybody published that information, it really wasn't high value. Online, there's a third dimension to people's information needs online. And that third dimension is exactly what Sam just said. It is the intensity of their desire for that information. And you can monetize that. I used to have arguments with friends of mine when I was living on the East Coast. I had a lot of friends working out here for the San Francisco Chronicle, sfgate.com. And every day in my inbox, I would get an email from the Chronicle that had basically all their San Francisco Giants coverage. And I used to tell my friends, if you tried to charge me for, you know, SFGate, I wouldn't pay. But if you gave me a little bit more in that newsletter, a little bit of stuff that I couldn't get anyplace else, I am so passionate, God help me, about the Giants, that I'd pay you for that, because it would appeal to that third dimension of my information needs and desires, which is the intensity with which I want that information. And so I absolutely agree with Sam that you can build businesses around that, and you can build successful businesses. And, you know, I think that is, you know, it's really interesting what you're doing, Sam, because that seems to me to be exactly the lesson that the medium has been trying to teach us now for 20 years.
Yeah, it works quite well. And what's cool is that, like, pretty much for any hobby you have, there's enough people, for most hobbies, there's enough people to make a living at it. But I think that the mistake that a lot of people make is, and I made this mistake when we first started, is I was not really like being authentic to myself. I was creating a lot of stuff that I thought people wanted. And then I was like, oh, screw that. I'm just going to do what I think is interesting. And it turns out there's loads of people who enjoyed the same stuff I enjoyed. And so that makes life way easier when you can appeal to these small things. And that's what I was saying earlier about like YouTube or companies like us. Like, we can go out and buy other companies or get bought, and we can be like the entrepreneurship tech vertical. Then you could have this other vertical. Then you could have this other vertical, but you have one hub that maybe can supply HR or finance, whatever. Anyway, I think that will be the move, as opposed to a large brand that covers everything.
Media people usually break down into three groups: creation, distribution, and monetization. What are the biggest challenges within media these days? Is it the creation side, the distribution side, monetization, or actually none of those are critical issues?
I think creation, it's never been easier. It's hard to make good stuff. That's always going to be the case. We're not spending a lot of money to do this. If we wanted to, we could have just put this phone here and someone would have heard it. That's easy, I think. Now, it's hard to make good stuff, obviously. So the creation's not the hard part, I don't think. I don't know, maybe you disagree.
Okay, so no, if creation is not the hard part, is there a hard part at all to this, that three
hell yeah
sector? Which one?
Yeah.
Which one is it?
Both.
Both. I think
so. Distribution and monetization.
What he said, exactly.
Well, like, look, like, yeah, the pipes change all the time. So, like, when we know our lifetime value of a user, so I can pay money on Facebook to advertise, and the prices get more expensive. Okay, so had I started 6 years ago, I would be way bigger because I would have acquired users for faster. So with marketing, this is how marketing works. It always works this way. One medium works super well. Everyone flushes, like runs to it, and then it dries up, and then you got to go find a new one. So right now, I don't know about you guys, but Facebook still works, and advertising on other publishers actually still works. A lot of stuff still works, but I think that nothing is like far and away better than anything else in terms of distribution.
In terms of smart news, we are a news aggregator. We have news from many, many sources.
Yeah, you are the distribution.
But we are also an audience aggregator because a lot of those sources would not be able to reach the scale of audience that that we can deliver. So in that regard, we're aggregating both. And you know, there are a few brands that are so strong and so powerful that they can effectively act as their own distributors and still reach a broad audience. But there are a lot of really high quality sources, and as Sam said, you know, creating high quality content it's never been easier to create content, but it's always going to be hard to create really high quality content. But there's a lot of high quality content out there that has trouble finding an audience. And that's one of the things that we can help media partners with. And increasingly, we are looking for ways to drive revenue to our partners as well to help them monetize that content so they can continue to create it or create even more and better.
What strikes me about both Hustle and Smart News is there's a fair bit of curation. And I see this just generally that people these days are so flooded with information that curation is a really critical part of their strategy as a media company. How do you all think about that?
I think that for us, when we first started, we tried to break a lot of news, and we realized that was a really, we were bootstrapped. We haven't raised any venture capital. We raised some angel money, but in order to do that, you needed a lot of resources, and we didn't have that. And then it kind of got lucky because we realized, like, man, we're trying to break all these stories, but that takes tons of time. You know what? Maybe this is kind of a commodity, the breaking part, not in all cases, but sometimes like one or two people do it, and then loads of other people do it. So it's like, well, what if we just took all of that and read everything and just told people exactly what they needed to know and gave our opinion on it as well? And so our users use that. I mean, that's a service. We're service providers, and so that's what we do for them. As we get bigger, we start doing more analysis, and we start getting original stuff. But when we first launched, we just couldn't afford it. And it turns out that people liked it.
Well, in my view, I mean, curation is a very powerful model, but the question has to be asked, you know, what criteria are you using to curate? In our case, we use technology. We use machine learning and we use algorithms, but we use those algorithms in a way that is different than the way many other people curate. We're not just obsessed with click-through rates and things that will get people worked up. We're actually trying to inform people and to give people a balanced information diet and give them access to information that they might not otherwise see. It's interesting to me when you look at, you know, App Store reviews sometimes of Smart News, you'll find people who will say, you know, I'm conservative and I saw an MSNBC story on Smart News. These guys are all left-wingers. Or I'm liberal and I just saw a Fox News story. These guys are all right-wingers. If you look at our engagement metrics, we are we have a far more engaged audience than pretty much any other news aggregator. And to me, those are two sides of the same coin. Because when all you see is what you, quote, expect to see or, quote, already know, over time that gets boring because you're never exposed to anything that is unusual or different, and you're never taken out of your comfort zone. It gets boring. So, you know, at least in terms of political coverage, people will sometimes see stories from sources that they wouldn't otherwise see. And we think that's a feature, not a bug. But it also has to do with there's a lot of other content that isn't politically loaded that you might not otherwise see except in Smart News. And I'm constantly coming across stories and going, you know, there's no other aggregator that would serve me up a story about efforts to save the Tasmanian devil in Australia, which was not something I would have said ahead of time I was interested in, but I can tell you I read every word of that story. It was a fascinating story.
Was that from the Dodo?
No, it was actually from, I think it was from Australian Broadcasting Company.
Cool. Speaking of what you consume, where and what do you consume? Right? Do you consume it on Facebook, and do you consume certain content? Sam, you first.
Yeah, I read The Hustle, obviously, but besides, I said YouTube, besides those two, Reddit. I love Reddit. That's one of my go-tos. Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, I read on a regular basis, and of course, TechCrunch. Those are kind of my morning routines, but I probably spend most of my time on Reddit.
I get a lot of my information from Smart News. But I'm an old media guy, you know, I've been around long enough so that, I have very ingrained habits in that regard. And, you know, the New York Times and news organizations that I worked for and respected, you know, the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg, I certainly get a lot of information from them. I get information also though from, you know, the BBC, when I'm making the bed in the morning, as I said earlier, because I'll have Alexa, you know, give me the BBC and NPR. So, you know, I think those are probably the main ones, and they reflect my generation and they reflect my career history as well.
So a lot of Americans can get their media from Reddit, Facebook, Instagram, and I'm curious, do you all see Facebook as a media company?
No, they're a tech company. I mean, I get asked that question every once in a while. I don't think it matters. I think that I said this earlier. I don't really care about the answer because it is what it is. It's its own thing. I don't care what we call it. It is what its own thing. But if I had to label it, I would say they are a tech company. Now, what is Netflix? I don't know. That's a hard question to answer. But Facebook is fully technology. I mean, walk around that campus and tell me who's employed there. It's mostly engineers.
Rich?
Well, I'm going to answer that question. I use the word media as many other people do very loosely, but I am a news guy. And to me, if you're a media company, particularly if you are presenting news to people that that they are depending upon, you have a certain responsibility for what you are delivering. And I don't think Facebook exercises that level of responsibility. So if they wanted to be considered a media company, and I don't think they do, or if they wanted to be considered an important and a responsible source of news, they would have to impose and enforce standards that they have shown repeatedly they have no interest in or appetite to enforce.
Going back to operators and media, what advice generally do you have for people who are going to be coming into this industry?
I already answered my thing. I said write for one group of people. I would say
niche.
Yeah, niche. I think that when I started, I looked at like a lot of the companies that had started before me. So companies that are now like the BuzzFeeds or Vices of the world, and I thought I wanted to be like that. And then I quickly learned that that was a horrible idea to emulate those folks because they have poor models. So I would say don't really try to look at the playbook of the generations brand, or not the generations, but the handful of years before you're starting and don't worry about following those rules. It's possible to create something totally fresh with new models and new strategies because that's what's going on now and it's working.
And I guess I'd answer that as the single most important skill for somebody coming into media is the ability to absorb new skills, because you cannot possibly imagine what skills are going to be needed in the future. And you know, the most important skill is to be adaptable.
Gentlemen, I really appreciate your time. This has been a really insightful conversation. The importance of being adaptable, niches to win, taking time to think. Really appreciate you all. This has been a great episode on media operators. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Rich.